Hello everyone, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And we are historians. If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we conduct intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And once again, we ask the question, what madness is this? Today, we are very delighted to welcome Dr. Lauren Burns to the Archive Fever hot seat. I should clarify right up front that our Lauren Burns is not, in fact, the Australian Olympic Taekwondo champion, though I wouldn't be surprised if our Lauren was capable of gold medal winning Olympian feats, such as her range of accomplishments. Our Lauren Burns is an aeronautical engineer who has worked for Boeing all over the world, a social justice advocate, legal reformer, writer, environmental activist, and new mother. Lauren was donor conceived at Prince Henry's Hospital in Melbourne in 1983, an origin story she only discovered at the age of 21. Her subsequent archival and legal journey to find her biological father is the subject of her first book, Triple Helix. Lauren has appeared extensively across print, radio and television media, including SBS's Insight, ABC Radio's Law Report, The Drum and Fairfax newspapers. In 2014, her story was profiled in a two-part episode of Australian Story titled Searching for C11, which won the Walkley Award for Social Equity Journalism. From 2016 to 19, Lauren was a board member of the Victorian Assisted Reproductive Treatment Authority, and she now lives in coastal Victoria and splits her time working as an aerospace engineer, volunteering for various environmental NGOs, and writing. Lauren, welcome to Archive Fever.
Thanks, Claire. Thanks, Eve.
Lauren, we're so excited to have you on the show for a range of reasons, not least of which is that you are a fair dinkum scientist, which is an exciting change from our broad humanities bias. So let's go there first. Research has, of course, been seminal to your academic life as a scientist, and your doctoral work looked at, and I want to get this right, because this is like a different language for me, basically, so I'm going to step myself through it. Bio-inspired design of aerospace composite structures. Specifically, your thesis investigated ways to improve the strength and toughness of carbon fibre aircraft parts.
Yes, I actually tried to simplify it. So,
well, thanks for doing that. Science for dummies here. As we'll also see later, medical archives, as well as that scientific research. When we get to your book a bit later, we'll see that medical archives have been crucial to unlocking the mystery of your conception. So I want to ask, when did you first get bitten by the research bug?
I think when I was studying my undergraduate degree and did my final year thesis, and then I think it was a mixture of being excited to avoid having to go out and get a real job for the next 3 years, but also being really excited by the idea of being on the frontier of knowledge, pursuing a PhD. And I had an opportunity to work with industry as well, with Boeing. So I wanted my work to be relevant and not just gathering dust on the shelf of some random library. So yeah, I think I had just the idea of developing new ideas and discovering what had never been known before really appealed to me.
And you're a beautiful writer, as your book shows. Was there a choice in your mind between science and a broader humanities bent, or was it always science for you? Was the research bug that bit you very clearly science one?
No, I was actually very conflicted in high school and towards the end of year 12, you know, what I should do after high school. So I really seriously considered studying journalism as my next move, but I ultimately settled on aeronautical engineering. I think I figured that my writing, I could pursue that as my own interest, whereas the maths and the sciences really rigorously study that to pursue a career in that direction. But yeah, I was really torn, and I always felt it's seen as such a dichotomy between humanities and science, but I always felt like in my own brain that they were very connected, and people ask, are you a maths or an arts person? And I always felt like I was both.
So obviously, I'm really out of my comfort zone here, but can you tell us what aerospace engineering research looks like? Like, what does an aerospace engineer actually do?
Yeah, good question. I don't think I even knew that before I started the course, which is probably quite common for uni students. So basically, it's about the design of aircraft. There's different facets of that. So, you know, I focused a lot on the structures, which is like the physical parts that are put together. But there's also like aerodynamics, which is how it flies, you know, through the air, and propulsions, so that's like the engines that power it. So there's kind of different sub-disciplines within. But yeah, I focused on the material science and the structure side.
And so that's where the carbon fibre business comes in.
Yeah, exactly. So carbon fibre is a very lightweight material. It's incredibly strong and stiff. So, you know, it has the capacity to reduce the weight of aircraft, which is really important. Obviously, when you're flying, you want to try and be as lightweight as possible.
And how does that kind of translate into day-to-day research? Like, what did a day of research in your PhD look like?
Yeah, so I was also drawn to my topic because it was quite interdisciplinary. So as Claire mentioned, I was looking at bio-inspired designs. So it's actually looking into natural materials like trees and wood, and even things like shell and bone, how natural materials develop very high strength and stiffness, and if there's something that we could learn from that and translate back to sort of our engineered materials. So it was kind of at the intersection of biology and material science and engineering.
And when you're in the flow of that, what does it feel like for you? What does aerospace research fever feel like for you?
Generally, there's a lot of numbers involved, so you can kind of get lost in the numbers sometimes. You know, day to day, you might be like on the computer doing a program, you might be building a model, or you might be handling sort of large data sets of numbers. So you can get into a flow, which I also found there was a similarity in the writing, in that you're lost and then something will kind of fall into place and, you know, everything will collapse into like a single graph or something like that. It's like when your difficult passage of your book will fall into place and it's kind of a little bit transcendent, you know, like you've been toiling away for days or weeks over it, and then finally there can just be that shift and what was hidden can become obvious.
And are the numbers addictive?
A little bit, yeah. I think typical engineers like very analytical and can be always like chasing this idea of like the optimum or the perfect design. And often in real life industry, you're like, oh no, 80-20 rule, you know, 80% there is good enough, we'll just move on. But, you know, you can always be chasing just that idea of perfection.
So how did your background as a scientist set you up for the research journey that you unexpectedly embarked on upon learning that you were donor conceived? And maybe just you could run us through that story. So the moment that that information was dropped in your lap.
Yeah, so it was just a few days after I'd turned 21. This is back in 2005. So you can cast your mind back. It was pre-iPhone, you know, didn't have a Facebook page, did have a MySpace, I think. So, and yeah, my mum sat me down and very unexpectedly, she told me that my dad wasn't my biological father. And that was, yeah, it was completely shocking news to me. And in that moment, my sense of identity really shattered. And I just had so many questions of like, who was I? Who was my biological father? Did I have any siblings? You know, it really kind of ricocheted through my whole sense of identity and the way I saw myself in the world.
So you wanted answers. I guess any research project starts with a point of critical inquiry. You know,
yeah.
What, where, when, how, why? Those are the questions that any historical project starts with, those questions. So was that the genesis of the research journey that you embarked upon?
Yeah. And, you know, in my undergraduate degree, one of the professors wrote me a reference, and he wrote, "Her quest for knowledge is relentless." So I think that was, a little bit there. And actually it was quite concurrent. So I started my PhD in 2009, which was really, as I was developing those research skills, it was actually in real time kind of informing my very personal search for my biological father and my identity. So that sort of late noughties period, there was a real kind of transformation in technology and social media and internet that was sort of opening up all these possibilities for archival research. And as you mentioned, I'd been conceived at the Prince Henry's Hospital, which actually no longer existed. So it was on St Kilda Road next to the Victorian College of the Arts. Those records had transferred to the Public Records Office of Victoria. But sort of compounding this sense of shock at the revelation of my mother, with also this sense of disempowerment, because the law actually locked me out of ever knowing where I came from. So I had no avenues to officially search for information, but you know, in the first early years, I think I was just always subconsciously searching, just searching faces, you know, walking down the street, on a tram, people that might look like me. But it wasn't till about 2008, 2009 that my search took on a more kind of structured approach. So it was really like a detective experience, like just these little clues kind of dribbled out. Like I spoke to a fertility counsellor who used to work at Prince Henry's, and she told me that my donor code, which was C11, you know, I had this obsessive fever to sort of crack this code, that actually the C stood for the first initial of my biological father's surname. So that was like a little clue. And I also found out just from experiential knowledge of people around at the time that a lot of the donors came from Monash University, who were studying medicine. It was like a common source of donors. And looking at myself, I was very interested in science and biology, obviously, with my PhD. And so I thought that kind of fit with my own aptitudes. So one of my initial researchers was looking at some of the degrees conferred from Monash during the 1980s. And believe it or not, I actually had a list which included the name of my biological father, but I just didn't know that he was the one. Had about 10 or 15 men on that list.
Lauren, I think you just mentioned it before about realising you didn't have access to the archives. And I think one of the things that's so thrilling about your story, and another reason that even I wanted to speak to you so much, is that you experienced a situation that many researchers encounter, which is the brick wall, you know, the end of the rabbit hole. Yours was a legal dead end. So what did you do? You set about changing the law. I mean, that's just extraordinary. Tell us about that brick wall and then the way that you drove a wrecking ball through it.
It wasn't just me. It was really about a community of donor-conceived people and our supporters who built this movement to work together. So in Victoria from 1998, there was the Assisted Reproductive Treatment Act, which enabled donor-conceived people born after that date to have access to information after they turned 18. But it was like a multi-tiered system. So for people born before that law, which was only a prospective law, we weren't included with those rights. So in practice, that meant some people went back to their clinics, and some cases clinic policy, they would do an outreach, and if the donor consented, they would connect people. But my clinic at Prince Henry's had shut down. There was nowhere for me to go to do that. And it did feel like a brick wall. I felt like I was banging my head against it and getting just a black eye, and then realised that we did have to change the law, which was like an incredible undertaking. You know, I was only in my early 20s at the time, so it was quite daunting. We really just began talking to politicians, to Victorian MPs. That was like completely outside my comfort zone. You know, I didn't know my legislative council from my assembly or really anything about how law is written or is changed. You know, my first meeting was just really inauspicious. So it was with this stale, male and pale older MP. And there was something that was really personal. I hadn't even been able to talk to some of my best friends about being donor conceived. And so it was a big deal for me to sort of explain my story to this perfect stranger. And he kind of just listened, and then at the end just clapped his hand on my shoulder and was like, "What you don't know can't hurt you, and don't worry, at least you look normal."
Thanks for that.
So that was great. It was so interesting because a lot of the advocates were like young women, and we're facing like these power structures in the medical fraternity and in the law that was very male dominated. So my learning from that is just the importance of equal gender representation, because it was really like a lot of the female MPs that took up our cause initially, like Sue Penicue from the Greens and Jane Garrett and Christine Campbell from Labor, and also progressive male MPs as well. It was really through the power of personal stories that we were able to start to build our champions within the parliament. We found that was really our greatest weapon, was just if we could connect with people. It's really like this fundamental question of being, like, who am I? You know, everyone can relate to that. Everyone's been on that journey. And, you know, if we could crack the facade and get into the human behind the MP, and often they had their own personal experiences of family, of adoption or whatever, and they could get it, be like, yeah, I understand why it's important, medical history, fear of accidental incest, and just knowing your ancestors and the cultures and languages they spoke. And it was really fundamental. So we kind of slowly over time built this coalition, and then a big breakthrough was when we were able to get the issue referred to the Law Reform Committee of the Parliament. So that was where they had the resources to look in detail at how the law could be changed.
Lauren, I want to pick up on the thing that MP said to you, that what you don't know can't hurt you. You note in your book that it's estimated that 90% of donor-conceived people in your generations don't know about their origins. It's a huge number of people walking mm-hmm. around in ignorance of their personal histories. And I wonder if, in your view, do you think that donor conception still affects someone, even if they don't know about it? And is it a kind of matter of epistemic injustice not to be told?
Yes, I think it definitely does affect people even when they don't know. And it was very much was a sense of justice that kind of drove me in that pursuit of law reform. So, for example, you know, when you go to your doctor and you give your medical history, you might inadvertently not know about something that's really important there. And that came up as well in my book with my friend Narelle and her kind of journey with cancer. Also, people sometimes talk about this feeling of genetic bewilderment. It's like they can't quite put their finger on it, but something in their upbringing or in their family, they can sense there's a secret there, or they might just feel that they're quite different, brilliant at playing musical instrument, or they might be tall and fair and their other family doesn't look like them. There's a sense of bewilderment that can often actually be a relief to find out the truth, you know, because like, okay. So almost subconsciously, people can sense it. So yeah, I think that it is really important. It's never too late for parents to tell their children the truth. And it's really difficult, but when the dust settles, you can get to a new and better reality for everyone.
Lauren, your book is so beautiful and there's so many moments in it that are, as you say, deeply human. And these are the stories that connect us all, even if we haven't got something like a donor conception as a genesis story. One of the parts I loved was when you wrote that after your mother broke the news to you, you were, and I'm quoting, wounded in a place you couldn't locate. I'm wondering whether the physical act of archival research, you know, the kind of piece by piece, as you've described it, like the detective story, the one foot in front of the other nature of it, did that help you heal that wound, find the source of that wound, or give you a sense of control back over the powerlessness that you were feeling?
Yeah, I think that there has been a lot of healing aspects. One of that has been just that connection with community of other donor-conceived people and adopted people and other people that have that experience of separation from close biological family. So that's been really supportive. You know, also something I can talk about now with my mum, and she can be open and we can just be much more open within our family and within our friends and the wider community. And yeah, also taking back the power was a really big source of healing and satisfaction for me and for others. And it's really interesting because my search period was sort of like 2005 to 2010 kind of period. And in that time, the power dynamic was so steep towards the clinics that held the records, held the power. But in that time, there's been a real flip in the development of consumer DNA testing, has really changed the game on that. So it's really interesting that at the time, the most important archive, as I said, was the Public Records Office of Victoria. But for donor conceived and adopted and other people today, the most important archive is their own DNA.
Is there anything, Lauren, in that research journey that you went on that you uncovered that you wished that you could unsee? Like that you could shove the archival genie back in the bottle?
Not really. You know, I believe that the truth kind of sets you free, so to speak, and that it's important to shine a light on what happened. And we did come across some ethical failings that I think were allowed to proliferate because of the anonymity of the time. So even though Prince Henry's was a public hospital, there was this real tension, I suppose, between record keeping typical of medical procedures and hospitals, but also this strong cultural pressure towards anonymity. And that had its roots in a lot of shame and stigma around infertility and also legal uncertainty around the various parties and could the donor be held liable as a parent and could they make claims on the child. So I can kind of see that at the time there was uncertainty that drove this decision towards anonymity. But also, you know, we know now that there were a lot of ethical failings, like cases of where sperm was used to make many families and individuals, you know, upwards of like 30, 40, 50. Sometimes it was imported interstate to South Australia without proper records and donors were not, their identity wasn't verified. So in one case, I know a donor conceived person who found out her biological father was a 16-year-old schoolboy who had donated in the school holidays for a bit of extra cash, and names weren't checked. A donor impersonated other people. Some people found that their donors had mental health problems that can be partially genetically inherited. So yeah, there was a lot to uncover, and I suppose I was lucky that, fortunately for me personally, I was welcomed by my biological family and I didn't have to personally face a lot of those challenges. I think it has been difficult, but I think ultimately the thing to do is to shine a light on it to make sure that things can improve.
Lauren, you mentioned a moment ago that, you know, the most sort of important archive for donor-conceived people now is DNA. And you did your kind of research journey before that became commonplace. But in a sense, your body was still kind of acting as an archive of your personal history. You write about how you were often mistaken for someone, well, perceived as someone with Scandinavian heritage, and then later discovered that you did have Scandinavian heritage through your paternal grandmother. So your body had kind of been speaking these truths the whole time. Can you tell us sort of about learning to read the archive of your body and kind of coming to terms with what it had to tell you?
Yeah, I think a lot of donor-conceived people can relate that our body is an archive in our faces. So you often hear people say that when they find out the truth, you know, late discovery as an adult, and this happened to me as well, it's almost like you don't recognize your own face in the mirror anymore. When I had no other way to search for information, it was just basically looking at my mother and myself and then deducing what my biological father might be like, which actually was quite surprisingly quite accurate. And then things like I thought I inherited certain physical characteristics from my dad, but it turned out that we aren't biologically related, even though obviously had a big impact through like the experience and psychology of growing up and still being my dad, but not my biological father. So it's a really interesting area of, you know, of science. It would have been unfathomable back in the 70s and 80s that today you can do a DNA test for like less than $100. That's something that would have cost millions of dollars and taken months, if not years, and now can be done just in a laboratory within a few weeks. So incredible tool and power of technology that is really now anonymity is obsolete, really. Like I know in the US and places they still sign up donors under the promise of anonymity, but the reality is that if people want to find them, they can be found now through DNA testing.
Lauren, you've gestured at it. We'll do the reveal. Your father, as it turned out, was a member of a famous literary dynasty in Australia, royalty, you might say. Benedict Clark, who turned out to be C11, is the son of Manning Clark, Australia's most renowned historian, and grandfather of Anna Clark, who has also been a guest on Archive Fever this season. You write in the book that the search for your family history has unearthed a family of historians. You come to understand this revelation as, and these are your words, a long, strange, self-referencing loop. So tell us about the answer coming before the question, as you put it. These are not necessarily archives of the body, but you also found something of yourself in this family, clues that started to make other things about yourself make sense.
Yeah, I suppose the triple helix of the title is about DNA and experience and psychology that makes us who we are, and obviously in reference to my three biological, social and legal parents. I think the answer that comes before the question in the book is I really wrote the book to answer this question I was so commonly asked, which is why did I need to find my biological father? It was so interesting because you talk to some people and they're like, of course, it's self-obvious why. And for others, it was like completely incomprehensible why I needed to find that. So I think in our literary and arts culture, often there's this idea of like unexpected reveal of family, which is like a plot twist, you know, like in Star Wars or The Kite Runner or anything like that. So I think as a collective consciousness, we do understand that there is significance there. But in the context of assisted reproductive treatment, often it's viewed more through like a medical lens and it's not really seen as having like any social or human impacts. So part of my reason for writing the book was that I really wanted to personalize this kind of shadowy system. But to your question, meeting the Clark family, who are wonderful, warm and quirky and funny family, it was almost like a jigsaw puzzle falling into place for me because I saw so many of my own looks and interests mirrored in that family, and that was really satisfying for me. And even things like we all drove Subaru Foresters, like it was kind of funny. And Anna and I were quite similar in our looks and interests. Also, just having a PhD was normal in that family, whereas in my family, no one had done a PhD before, even though they were quite academic and well educated.
Reading your book, which is beautifully written, as Claire said, I felt like there was an echo of Anna Clark's writing style because, you know, I've been familiar with Anna's work for many years as a fellow historian. And, you know, as you said, you look quite similar and have similar interests, but I felt there was a kind of similar writerly voice that came out as well, which was quite fascinating.
Yeah, I just read her book, Making Australian History, which is brilliant, so I recommend that highly to everyone. And that was also, I think, what distinguished Manning Clark. You know, he looked at the inner life of these historical figures and he placed value and emphasis on people's spiritual and inner struggles, not just history being facts and figures. And that, I suppose, also made him a controversial historian. And that's also what I explore in the book, is the difference between knowledge and experience and different ways of knowing. You know, in history, it's very biased towards written archives and not so much towards things like oral histories. But for me, you know, in finding the Clark family, I was always really hooked on, you know, all of the stories they could tell about the family, you know, about Dimfner and Manning living in Canberra and Bob Hawke dropping by for a cup of tea and a game of ping pong and so on. And that was sort of the most meaningful thing to me. Like, if I had mapped my entire genome, you know, that wouldn't have given me the answers I was looking for. It was really about that personal connection for me.
There's this gorgeous line in the last two pages of your book. No spoilers here, don't worry. But I couldn't let you go without reading this line back to you. You write, "As an engineer and writer, over the years I've learnt that a willingness to look beyond the boundary of the verifiable can be rewarded with the beauty of truths unprovable." So this sounds dangerously like archive sacrilege here. You've hinted at this, but what really led you to this anti-empiricism?
Just the limitations, I suppose. Obviously, I'm a big advocate of science. You know, I'm a scientist and engineer, but the scientific method is really powerful when applied appropriately. But, you know, it's not always appropriate for very complex systems like human psychology or sociology. You have complex systems with many variables that change over time. So you can't always replicate the exact same experiment and get the exact same result because, you know, in a community, things might have changed over time or there's just all these emergent complex properties of complex systems. So, yeah, I think we just need to recognize our universe is very much a connected universe. And in an experiment, you can't isolate the observer from the observed and subjective and objective. It's not actually a reality of the universe. And I think that modern scientific research is, you know, starting to get there. It's a very powerful and gives us great results and should be used where appropriate, but it's not appropriate in all contexts and it can't deliver us like the ultimate truths. So we have to look beyond that.
And did you feel like this understanding of, I suppose, the limits of science, did this emerge from your research journey to find your biological father? Like, did that process kind of change your relationship to science?
Yeah, it did. And, you know, when you look at some of the research into experience of donor-conceived people, you know, it's really difficult to put your finger on being wounded in a place you can't locate. Mm. Like, how do you scientifically prove that, right? Like, a lot of the methodology just interviews the parents and is based on, you know, quite young children and doesn't have a lot of, like, longitudinal studies of adults. And it can be difficult to measure. It can be quite qualitative rather than quantitative.
Lauren, since you've written and published the book, you've also become a mother. You've got a 13-month-old daughter now, Murray Sunset. I'm wondering whether she is in some way the last piece of the puzzle for you. How has becoming a mother yourself contributed to the journey that you set out on?
Yeah, I think that the whole experience of pregnancy and birth and motherhood is very mysterious. So, you know, in a lot of ways, I feel more empathy and openness towards people who perhaps struggled to achieve their dreams in that area. But it's also been quite healing in having a child of my own and, you know, just clearly see derivative personality from me and her dad and just knowing as well that she can grow up knowing her family tree and all of the various branches of it and she won't have to struggle as much as I did with uncovering that information that, you know, we already took her up to the family farm up on the south coast of New South Wales and, you know, that's just been a normal part of her life, like literally since she was 6 weeks old. So I feel satisfied that the intergenerational aspects, I hope she can have like a fully open book on where she comes from.
Now, Lauren, the final question I'm going to ask is one we ask all our guests here on Archive Fever. Do you have a dirty little archive secret you'd be willing to share with us?
Sure. So when I was a teenager, I was in the Air Force cadets. And so I suppose my dirty archive secret is I still organise my wardrobe from heaviest to lightest clothes, which is something they taught us to do like when we were on camp and we had room inspections. So that's my dirty archive secret.
The slightly anal organisation of your personal clothing archive.
Yeah, exactly.
I wish I organised my archives like that. It'd be useful. Some sort of order.
Yep.
Sadly, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us, Lauren. It's been a real pleasure.
Lauren's book, Triple Helix, My Donor Conceived Story, is published by UQP and is available from all good bookstores, virtual and analogue, now.
We'll put some links of Lauren's other writing on the website, as well as resources you can access if this episode has raised any issues for you.
You can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees. Don't forget that you can catch up on all of the seasons 1, 2 and 3 of Archive Fever via the website archivefeverpod.com, as well as our bonus episodes from 2022 Sydney Writers Festival and Adelaide Writers Week.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear. You can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees. And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land. Coming up in the next episode.
One would hope that historians who have different embodied experiences of time itself would be useful. One would hope that, and I will certainly continue to hope that as I keep trying to eke out a little bit of work. But again, I think there's maybe a little bit of work to do in the discipline on the idea that that could produce value.